Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 1st. Let the record reflect the time is 1:32 p.m. Today we have Senator Michicki, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Hughes, and Senator Schauer, who's just joined us. Please silence your cell phones. Thanks to those assisting us today. We have one item on today's agenda. The committee will take up a committee substitute for SB 12 by Senator Michicki, walk through the summary of changes to the bill and the revised sectional analysis. I'd like to ask committee members to please click your questions and comments focus on the bill before the committee. We're going to table all philosophical and positional speech making, mine included, so we can complete this very important policy work. And as always, concise questions and thoughtful brevity are the order of the day and is much appreciated. So just a brief background on this bill. Senate Bill 12 was introduced to the committee on February 13th. The committee reviewed the bill that day by section, and on February 18th, the committee heard invited testimony and open and closed public testimony. At the same meeting, I informed the committee of my intention to work with each office on ideas for a committee substitute, with ideas submitted to my office on February 22nd. Today, we will consider the committee substitute for SB 12. This committee substitute was distributed to members yesterday, and I'm hopeful you've had adequate time to review it. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 12, Work Order 31-LS0263/O, be adopted as the working document.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. I will object for purposes of discussion. I'd like to invite my Chief of Staff, Buddy Witt, and Staff Attorney Regina Largent up to the table to go over the summary of changes and the sectional analysis. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the summary of changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to the Chair Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Regina Largent, staff attorney to Madam Hughes.
And if it pleases the chair, I'll cover the explanation of changes as we go through the sectional, kind of at the same time, because they do coincide.
That does please the chair.
Okay, hanging around attorneys too long. So CS for sponsor substitute for SB 12. This is version O. Section 1 is unchanged from the previous version of the bill. But Section 1 amends AS 1141-200, assault in the first degree, to add a new subsection 5, which adds a person, quote, knowingly causes another to become unconscious by means of a dangerous instrument, and defines dangerous instrument in accordance with the definition found in Statute 1181-900. Section 2. In Section 2, it adds knowingly causing a victim to come into contact with semen to the definition of sexual contact in AS 1181-900. That was a typo. Okay. I will say that in Section 3 of the previous version of the bill, if you recall, Madam Chair, we had removed the word semen from the definition and description of the crime of harassment in the first degree. Semen has been put back into the description of harassment in the first degree, so that entire section is no longer in the bill. Now Section 3 of the bill repeals AS 1255-027-D and reenacts to specify that a court may not grant credit against a sentence for time in private residence or on electronic monitoring. That is all in pretrial. And Section 4 is a conforming amendment to AS 1255-027-E, which removes the words electronic and monitoring as an option for claiming credit towards a sentence of imprisonment. These next few sections, Madam Chair, if there are questions on it, I will hand it over to Ms. Largent, as she worked very long and hard on these enhanced sentencing structures for these crimes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Keel?
Madam Chair, do you want questions as we go along or hold them to the end? What's your preference?
Go ahead and ask them now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to back up to Section 2, had a couple of conversations. I think this is an excellent approach. I wanted to check on something because I don't have that law degree. By leaving contact with semen in the harassment statute, as well as including it here, there was one attorney who used a phrase, something like the principle of leniency or the precept of leniency. I want to make sure that we're not in a position where we have to charge non-consensual contact with semen as harassment, where we are able, in the Schneider case, to charge it here in the appropriate sex crimes.
Senator Keel, through the chair, to that question, the chair has specifically asked Mr. John Skidmore from the Department of Law to he'll come up after this is discussion is concluded and be able to address that specific issue. But they are prepared to explain how they would go ahead and proceed with differentiating between what is a sex crime and what is not with the way the statute or the bill is currently written.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Another section?
Okay, unless it's a more appropriate question to hold for Mr. Skidmore, or is it more technical that...
On section 3.
Okay.
I want to check in here. The discussion of the credit, or rather not allowing credit for time spent under electronic monitoring. Is this subsection we're repealing and reenacting specific to sex offenses, or does this reach more broadly than that?
Senator Keel, through the chair, my understanding is this would take away any credits in pretrial for electronic monitoring, regardless of the crime that they're being charged with.
And we'll,
the Department of Law could speak to that as well.
Yes, if Mr. Skidmore could be prepared to address that as well.
Thank you.
Continue, please. Ms. Largent, are you up with Section 5?
If there are more specific technical questions about what we're doing in each one of these sections, we can let Ms. Largent explain. Mm-hmm. Section 5 amends 1255.125C to add an enhanced sentencing structure for assault in the first degree when a dangerous instrument is used in the assault. And actually, as I look at this, I think I'd be more comfortable with Ms. Largent proceeding through Section 5, 6, 7, and 8.
Okay.
Ms. Largent, please state your name for the record again and proceed.
Regina Largent, and to the chair, Section 5, as Mr. Witt started with, the scheme here is actually an existing sentencing enhancement that exists in subsections of 1255.125C1 and 2 to crimes such as sexual assault in the first degree, unlawful exploitation of a minor, online enticement of a minor, those unclassified and Class A felonies. There's an existing sentence enhancement for a first felony plus dangerous instrument. And what we've done here in sections, in section 1255.125C, this is a subsection of the dangerous instrument statute. If you look at subsection B, 15B. B15B states that a dangerous instrument means hands or other objects when used to impede normal breathing or circulation of blood by applying pressure on the throat or neck or obstructing the nose or the mouth. So, and let me back up because I was starting to actually go into the sexual crimes enhanced sentencing. These three, sections 5, 6, and 7, apply Assault 1, Assault 2, and Assault 3. And it basically is a formula where you have charge of Assault 1 plus not just deadly instrument, but the subsection B of an object used to impede normal breathing or circulation, then that would have the enhanced sentencing. And we basically used a kind of a cascading effect there. In recognition of the seriousness of a crime, which in some jurisdictions could be considered attempted murder, to be frank. So, because when you put your hands around somebody's neck, death can easily, even you might think accidentally, occur, but the intent there is to either kill or to place somebody in fear of death. So this sentencing enhancement takes that into account, because we heard from previous testimony that most strangulations in the state of Alaska are charged as an assault in second degree, which is a very, I don't think that's the intent behind this current scheme, is recognizing that is a more serious and potentially deadly crime than assault too, takes it into account.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions on those three?
Seeing none, section 8.
Okay, section 8, and I apologize. That's what I was jumping forward into. Section 8. In section 8, again, we're taking an existing enhancement that applies currently for a first felony plus dangerous instrument, not the limited to just hands and objects to impede breathing, but dangerous instrument as laid out completely, to enhance a sentence. Currently, that's enhanced for sexual assault in the first degree, unlawful exploitation of a minor, online enticement of a minor, sexual assault of a minor in a first degree, and then attempted and conspiracy or solicitation of first degree sexual assault of a minor in a first degree, or sex trafficking in a first degree. So what we did was we applied that same structure, and in a consistent manner in terms of cascading those sentences down to what you see in 1255.125i subsections 3 and 4. 1255.125i 3 and 4. And I will list those out for you now. You will notice that there are a few crimes in there that this won't apply to, or it would be in a really odd scenario for distribution of pornography to also involve a deadly instrument, I guess, unless somebody was forcing somebody. But that's not an issue here, so I'm just going to list the ones that this would actually be charged with. The proposal is formula, first-degree felony plus a dangerous instrument to enhance the presumptive sentencing. Subsection 3, second-degree assault, sex assault, sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree, online enticement, and then in subsection 4, an attempt or a conspiracy or a solicitation of second-degree sexual assault of a minor, or unlawful exploitation of a minor, or incest, or indecent exposure in the first degree.
Could you, and I'm sorry, because I should have asked this when we were on the sections, I believe it was, the three sections that were not sexual crimes, but we were adding the enhanced sentences. Could you just give us an idea of the how the added number of years, what the added number of years does by enhancing the sentence, just to give members and the public an idea of when we're adding the serious subset of strangulation, how it impacts the actual sentence and the time someone might serve.
Thank you. To the chair, I want to make sure I understand. Are you asking me to go ahead and go through the three regular assault and then also then
yes.
Sexual assault?
Yes,
starting
please.
With assault.
No.
Right.
No, both non-sexual assault and sexual assault, okay. Please.
For starting with assault in the first degree, which is a Class A felony, current sentencing for a first is 3 to 6 years for the presumptive range. This would change the presumptive range for that first offense for 5 to 7. For an assault two, which is a Class B felony, the current sentencing, which is what happened in the Justin Schneider case, first felony, 0 to 2, this would change the presumptive range for 1 to 3. For an assault 3, which is a Class C felony, current presumptive range for a first felony is 0 to 2, and this would change that to 1 to 3. And so moving on to the sex crimes that I just listed.
And before you go on to those sex crimes, for second and third felonies in each of those categories, those presumptive ranges are also bumping up, correct?
Not under, I'm sorry. No.
Yeah.
We're just
oh,
bumping wait. Up.
The oh, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm
yes.
sorry. Yes, yes, the answer is yes. I apologize. Yes, the second felony, and I was thinking forward on the sex crimes because a different there's already a mechanism in place for the second felony in those cases. For the straight assault, not sexual, a second felony for Class A is currently 8 to 12. That would bump to 9 to 13. A third felony is currently 13 to 20. The third felony under the new proposal would be 14 to 20. For Class B felony, which is assault in a second degree, Class B, again, the first was currently a 0 to 2, proposing now 1 to 3. Second felony, currently a 2 to 5. In the bill, that second felony would result in a 4 to 6 years. And third felony for the Class C, currently 4 to 10. And in SB 12, the third felony would be 7 to 10, which would bring that up to the potential max. For assault 3, which is Class C felony, as I mentioned, the first felony is currently 0 to 2. This proposal puts it 1 to 3. Second felony is currently 1 to 4. SB 12 would bump that up to 2 to 5. Current for a third felony is 2 to 5. And the third felony under SB 12 would be 3 to 6.
Okay, thank you.
3 to 5.
3 to 5.
That's a typo on my paper. Yes.
3 to 5. And now the sexual crimes. Could you?
No, it's 3 to 6.
It's 3 to 5. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's correct. There was earlier discussion that the max currently under law is 5 for Class C felony. Ergo the typo. Okay, to the chair. SB 12 in Section 8. The current presumptive range for subsection for 1255I3, which again were the second degree sexual assault, sexual assault of a minor in the second degree, online enticement. For those crimes, the current presumptive range is 5 to 15. SB 12 would bump that to 10 to 25. So that is those sex crimes plus a dangerous instrument or serious injury. Subsection 4.
And just for clarification, that dangerous instrument, as you mentioned before, does include strangulation.
Does include strangulation. And again, here we were trying to capture, like in the Justin Schneider case, that was not ultimately is not convicted of a sex crime. So the enhancement, both with the straight assault and the sexual assault, is to fully, along with Senator Michicki's strangulation to the point of unconsciousness, cover three bases to close a gap, to close that loophole. So in subsection 4, again, applying to the crimes of attempt or conspiracy or solicitation of second-degree sexual assault, second-degree sexual assault of a minor, unlawful exploitation of a minor, or incest or indecent exposure in the first degree, currently the presumptive range for those crimes are 2 to 12. SB 12 would bump that presumptive range to 7 to 12 years.
Okay, thank you. And continue with the sectional summary.
Yes, ma'am. For the record, Buddy Witt again. Picking up in Section 9, Section 9 adds AS 1261015D as a new subsection that requires prosecuting attorneys to make a reasonable effort to confer with a victim of a sexual felony or that victim's legal guardian to ascertain if they agree with a proposed plea agreement. I will note that the victim would not be is not required to respond by law. However, when they do respond, a record of that consultation or attempted consultation, if they are not able to respond, is a requirement for the Department of Law. However, neither the prosecutor or any representative of the court is bound by that agreement or disagreement. It's just an informative piece, and that was brought to us by the bill sponsor.
Madam Chair.
Senator Keel.
could I get a little help understanding how this changes the practice? I think there's a section now that requires a prosecutor to confer with a victim before entering into a plea agreement.
Senator Keel, let's wait till we have Mr. Skidmore up. I think that's a more appropriate question for him. So okay. If you note that and then.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Finally, Section 10 is, it's another conforming section to Section 3 having to do with credit for electronic monitoring. Are we okay? And it repeals 1255.027G as in golf, which basically this is the section wherein it's specific again to pretrial time credit for time served, and it's specific to the 360-day maximum credit that the court may allow, and it's specific to the following crimes: felony crimes against a person under AS 1141, domestic violence crimes, sex offenses, delivery of controlled substances to a minor, burglary in the first degree, and arson in the first degree. This is currently in statute, allows the court to grant up to 360 days of credit when someone is on electronic monitoring and has been charged with those crimes. So this is simply repealing that section as well. So there will be no more pretrial credit for time served on electronic monitoring.
Okay, thank you. And that was that, and Section 11 applicability, Section 15 effective date.
And that is a typo. There is no actual Section 15. That should say Section 12. My apologies.
Oh, yeah. I see you went from 11 to, there you go. Okay. So do you have any other wrap-up comments before we bring Mr. Skidmore up?
I would just say, Madam Chair, that as far as Section 9 is concerned, the bill sponsor brought us that idea. And I would encourage the bill sponsor maybe to give his thoughts on the need for that. But that's just my two cents, and I'll bow out now.
Senator Bachicki, would you like to do that now, talk about Section 9? And
Certainly that might help Senator Keel as well on my approach. There is a requirement for consultation. I think the gap is recording and documenting that consultation and having a discussion as to whether or not the victim supports that plea agreement. I believe in this case it may have led to a different outcome, a better outcome. I was under the assumption that it was going to be difficult for a victim to agree that a plea agreement is the best deal, but frankly with sexual assault cases, sometimes the victim would rather not relive that experience in the courtroom, and in many cases would support the plea agreement, which is a much simpler process, not requiring their testimony. So although I think it will drive more discussions and consultation and recording that, if we want to go back later someday and perhaps determine what the outcome is of that consultation, I don't know that it will result in much of a change from what's occurring today on plea agreements. Sometimes that's the best you're going to get, and sometimes that plea agreement is the best for the victim, and that's the goal of this legislation.
Senator Bachicki, I have thought about that, and I think it is an excellent addition, because some victims don't want to relive the courtroom experience. However, if they're contacted to come to court, they may not want to do that. But if they're contacted, and there may be no response, which is, I think, perhaps sometimes the case, but if they're asked to review what the plea bargain might be, they might be more apt to come forward. And in that process, it could be they might make the decision to be more involved. And I think that's important to bring justice. So I think it's actually a very good amendment. As far as how it might work for the Department of Law, we can have Mr. Skidmore talk about that. But I think the more involvement with the victim, the better, and the greater chance of appropriate justice. So do you have further comments, Senator Keel, about that? Well,
Madam Chair, I like the goal. I'm looking for an understanding of how it's going to work on the ground in the DA's office and in the courtroom.
Okay, so Mr. Skidmore, if you want to come on up, you can pick up on that topic, and then I think Senator Keel had a couple other questions as well.
Good afternoon, Ladies and gentlemen, for the record, my name is John Skidmore, and I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. As to the most recent question that's been put in front of us is, how would this particular change in the law impact our practices? I would tell you that it is our practice as a department to consult with victims when we're able to get in touch with them. And we do, in fact, try and record all of those contacts in our files. What this change would be is that that recording of the contacts now is sort of a policy that the department has. The change that Senator Machicki amendment would cause is that the law would require us to record that in our files in addition. But in terms of practice, this was really the gold standard of what we want to achieve. So from that standpoint, it's certainly something that we would support.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Skidmore, the term shall make a reasonable effort. Do you have a sense of what that means in practice? And is there, do you see significant risk that in an overworked period, you're going to lose cases if a judge says the effort wasn't reasonable enough?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'm not concerned about that. The term reasonable effort is used already in other places in statute. It's something that I think the courts are very deft at interpreting, and we have not run into any problems. We certainly interpret it to mean that if we have contact information for a victim, phone number and address and email address, what have you, we should be utilizing those means to reach out to the victim. We'll often go beyond those methods if we're unsuccessful in making contact with a victim. There have certainly been cases in which we'll utilize law enforcement or go out and try and find the victim through other methods. Not every case requires that, but there are certainly some cases that do. So reasonable is the appropriate term to be placed in statute. It's certainly something that courts have had to interpret many times over, and thus far we've not encountered any issues with it.
Mr. Skidmore, in current practice, at what point in the process does the prosecutor reach out to the victim? Would it be at the very beginning as the case kicks off, or would the prosecutor also reach out at a later point to let them know about the plea bargaining?
To the chair, we reach out to victims when a case first starts. We have obligations to inform them of hearings that occur if they're interested in that information. So we reach out to them when we file charges. We try and do it before the arraignment, actually. And after that, we then will be in contact with them at various times, depending on what they communicate to us about how, to what degree they want to be involved in the case. We certainly reach out to any victim when it comes time to be doing change of pleas, to be seeking their input on those when we can. I can't tell you that we are perfect in our ability to reach out to all victims prior to plea agreements being reached. That's certainly our goal, and that's one of the things that we continue to look to improve each and every year. But we have obligations to let them know when the hearings occur, and certainly obligations to ensure that if they want to participate in any sentencing hearing, which is pretty much what a change of plea hearing is when the sentence is agreed to, that they have an opportunity to participate in those hearings and to let the court know what their position is if they desire to do so.
So the current general practice is that they would be reached out to multiple times, including at the point of a plea bargain agreement being reached, but you mentioned it may not be so perfect. It may not always be done. Do you believe by putting this in statute, there will be, not that they will be always successful reaching the victim and getting feedback, but that it will be done more consistently at that point in the process because of this change in law?
To the chair, having it placed in law certainly provides additive incentive, because now you want to be complying with the law. So there's certainly added incentive associated with that. So I hope that's responsive to your question.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear, because I want to know that it's being done consistently at that point. I'm glad it's been done often, but I think the goal, and I believe the sponsor of the bill would agree, is that it is done consistently at this point. Are there any other questions? Well, you, Senator Keel, you had a couple other items earlier in the, as they were reviewing the summary. Did you want to ask those questions?
Oh, sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see if I can find my notes. Term that I heard an attorney use, and don't necessarily know the question of including semen in the definition of sexual contact, leaving it in the crime of harassment, and ensuring that the Department of Law will have the tools to charge something like the Justin Snyder case as a sex crime, which it should be, and not be bound by the principle of leniency to charge a lesser crime because it also includes the same basic element.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I will tell you that the Department of Law had those concerns initially when we had looked at drafting the legislation as we were working our way through it. However, we believe that there are actually different elements that will allow that distinction to be made. And if I may, let me point out those elements for you.
Please.
When you're looking at a sexual assault case, when you have the term without consent, that actually is a term that many folks may use in their common day speaking with one another, but it's different when we use it in statute and by law. It's one of those funny things where the law gives a particular definition to a phrase. And in this particular case, the concept of without consent requires the use of coercion and force. So, for example, we talked about the situation with a corrections officer that would have bodily fluid flung on them. That is not through coercion and force. So that's a very different concept than what you had, for instance, in Justin Snyder's case, where there was coercion and force used in that circumstance. And that's really the distinction between the two that you're able to utilize and why we believe that we can appropriately draw distinctions between the two.
Follow-up, Senator Keel?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Not on that
you,
one.
You didn't, did you have another question on another section or matter? Was that it? Seemed like you had a third one.
I guess I excuse me. We haven't spent significant time on the question of the credit for time on electronic monitoring pre-trial. And so I'm not generally of the opinion that a lot of folks charged with sex crimes should be out pre-trial. But I guess if this committee substitute is going to eliminate all credit for being out pre-trial, I could use a better understanding of the implications of that, especially for folks with addiction problems who we want to be in treatment and have in treatment, and whether we're changing the incentive structure in a way that makes Alaskans safer or not.
So, yes, if you could speak to that, and when you explain how it might work, if you could also explain the administration's thought processes of why it is in the bill as proposed, I know this is Senator Michicki's bill, but I believe this was an element of SB 35 at one point, so I believe that you could speak to the thought processes of the administration. Am I correct on this particular item?
Madam Chair, you are correct that it is in one of the administration's bills. It was not 35.
Okay.
It was actually 34, if I'm not mistaken. Excuse me, 33. But I can speak to the thought process behind it, and I'd be happy to answer Senator Keel's question. So through the chair, Senator Keel, the first thing that I want to assure you of is that this particular provision, and just so that we're all clear, we're talking about page 2, section 3, which is Alaska Statute 1255-127D. That particular subsection talks about credit for electronic monitoring or in the private residence. That is not a subsection that talks about credit for being in a treatment program. So you are not changing the ability for somebody to get credit when they're in a treatment program under this subsection. That is still in law. If this passes, you still get credit when you're in a treatment program. All this impacts is electronic monitoring. And the reason that electronic monitoring really is problematic is twofold. First, when someone is sentenced for having committed a crime, and they are committed to the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections conducts a risk assessment analysis, and they are making decisions about how to house or how to classify every offender. Does this offender need to be in maximum security? Does this offender need to be in minimum security? Where is this offender most appropriately classified for both the offense that they've committed and for other factors they look at for each particular defendant? So it's an individualized assessment. That's a very different assessment than what's made at the time that you are determining whether or not somebody should be released pretrial. There's a very significant difference in that when you are pretrial, someone is presumed to be innocent. Once you are convicted, that presumption no longer applies. You have definitively been found guilty. You have either pled guilty or a jury has found you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's a very different basis from which you start just in that regard. The second thing that I would say about that is that the assessment pretrial is really only supposed to be evaluating two things. One, is the person a flight risk? Well, the Department of Corrections and their classifications, I'm not the expert on that classification, but I doubt when they are housing people, are they saying to themselves, you know, how much of a flight risk is this person? That may be some part of it in terms of escape, but that's not one of the major components the way it would be pretrial. The second thing that the pretrial assessment has to look at is this person a danger to the community if we let them out pretrial? The classification that the Department of Corrections is going to be using is going to be far more complex than that when they're determining how to house somebody. If you have further questions on that, I would defer to the Department of Corrections to answer that because that's not my area of expertise. But I know enough to know that those two determinations are very, very different. So that's the first piece. The second piece that's also important to remember about this is that what we found is that our pretrial population in prison has increased significantly over the number of years. I think when SB 91 was passed, the number was somewhere in the neighborhood of 81% over 10 years or something to that effect. What that looked at is the pretrial population is determined by how long someone is in a DOC facility awaiting that determination of their case, that guilt determination. Are they innocent? Are they guilty? Is that done by a plea? Is that done by a trial? They're waiting for that determination. If that period of time, from the day they're charged to the time that determination is made, was static, it was the same for everyone, and you saw an 81% increase, you would say, oh my goodness, we have a huge problem here in terms of we must be admitting far more people than we were in the past. That's problematic. But that's not the only way in which that number can change. It's not just a vertical in this way, but it's also a horizontal because you can have increases in the time frame from arraignment, from the time the case starts, till the time the case is resolved. One of the factors that has not been looked at very carefully yet is that increase in pretrial delay. Having worked in the field for 20 years and having sat on many different groups where we discuss those topics, I can tell you there is an increase in pretrial delay. That also contributes to the problems that we have in managing the population. Now, you're sitting here thinking, that's a great explanation, Mr. Skidmore, but what in the world does any of that have to do with this particular section of the bill? That's what your question was about. Here's how it's connected. If you say that somebody can sit in pretrial on electronic monitoring and get credit towards their sentence, they have every incentive to delay when that case is resolved, when they engage in that change of plea, when they want that case to go to trial. And the longer they delay, the longer they're on electronic monitoring, the less time they actually end up serving in jail, if it's appropriate for them to serve it in jail. Maybe the Department of Corrections will determine this person wasn't an appropriate person to serve time in jail. But that's not what DOC has done at that point. And in fact, what this particular statute does is it takes that determination away from the Department of Corrections. It now says, we're going to decide who should be going to jail based on what their pretrial risk was. Those are two different concepts, and it delays getting cases resolved. Delay is always the friend of the defendant. It is never the friend of the prosecution. It is even far worse for victims. We have victims that come into court time and time and time again, only to have the case delayed again and again and again. They take time off of work, they take time off of school, they rearrange their lives, they arrange childcare for their children, they come into court, nope, it's going to be delayed again. And what this does is it says there really should be a shorter period of time in which cases get resolved. This removes that incentive for that pretrial delay. And that's really what the driving motivating factor is. So while I agree with you, this particular provision is not focused just on sex offenses. The scenario I've just described is not limited only to sex offenses. That same scenario applies to every property offense. Everybody that's had their car stolen, that same concept applies to everyone that's had their house burglarized. That same concept applies to everybody that is assaulted, not sexually, just physically assaulted. All of those victims that are out there have this same problem. And this provision is problematic for all of those reasons. So that's really what the administration's approach was in saying that that needed to be eliminated.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Keel.
Can you help me with the notion that after sentencing, it is the Department of Corrections that determines whether somebody goes to jail? I thought the judge determined that.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I apologize if I misled you in that. It is the judge who determines whether or not somebody goes to jail. What I said is that the Department of Corrections determines how to classify somebody and where they should be serving the sentence based on that classification determination. There's actually a statute that the legislature has authorized the Department of Corrections to have certain people be released on electronic monitoring to serve their sentence. But that's a calculation that the Department of Corrections makes, and there's a whole series of factors that are listed in statute that are different than the factors that are considered pretrial. So is it possible to serve a sentence on electronic monitoring? The answer is yes. But the judge determines how long someone should receive a sentence. The Department of Corrections then ultimately says, is this person a good candidate for EM or not?
Senator Michiki has a question on that topic.
Senator Schauer, was that on this subject? Because yes. He was first, Madam Chair.
I don't care. I mean, I'm just going to ask you the question.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Mr. Skidmore, in this, I'm going to expand this just a little bit, but just very briefly. So you said before, I believe, that this is taken up again in SB 33. So my question to you would be, since this is very narrowly tailored for this particular bill, but affects so many other things, is that something, I'm asking ahead here because we're going to see that soon, is that something we should be looking at across the board in SB 33, and is that the appropriate vehicle for all of these other cases to look at that particular issue of the pretrial delays and where that needs to be? It, kind of in line with what Senator Hughes said, had asked.
So through the chair, Senator Schauer, the concept that is found here in SB 12 is the same concept that's found in 33. So it's approached in the same way. When 33 comes up in a particular committee hearing, I'll likely be there, and I'd be happy to provide the explanation in that context for that particular bill. But the fact that it's in 12 doesn't create any problems for us. We don't know which of these bills gets across the finish line, I think is the phrase people use. And whether it's in 12 or in a different bill, getting that concept changed in law will be appropriate and helpful.
Understood. Thank you.
Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to help with Senator Keel's question as well. His question, when he framed it, it was specifically on substance abuse, and we're looking at returning first-time simple drug possessions to a felony. So on that, using that lens, simple drug possession and a treatment plan, can you just also explain the benefits of suspended imposition or entry, which would allow a felon, although they may be sentenced, to complete their treatment plan outside of the prison, perhaps not serving any time for that, which would sort of serve the same purpose in a treatment plan as providing credit for time served on electronic monitoring?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, those are two different concepts that both achieve the same goal, I think, is the point that you're making. Mm-hmm. But to explain it more thoroughly, there is a provision in statute, I believe it's also in 1255.127, it's just a different subsection, that authorizes credit against an ultimate sentence that's imposed for treatment, for time spent in a residential treatment program. In addition to that, there are other tools, and one of the tools that Senator Michiki just mentioned is something called an SEJ, otherwise known as a suspended entry of judgment. And what a suspended entry of judgment says is that the prosecution and the defense can agree that a defendant should go and complete a certain set of conditions, kind of like probation, but you're not yet convicted. You complete this certain set of conditions, and under a suspended entry of judgment, you can actually avoid a conviction on your record altogether. So, for example, you take a person that's in charged in with possession of drugs for some sort of addiction reason. They're charged with that possession of drugs. That case could be resolved by saying you need to go to treatment, and that treatment could even be more than 6 months. It could be more than a year. The statute does not limit the prosecution and the defense's ability to talk about how long that treatment should be. So it's another vehicle that allows that to occur. The difference between that and what would be in statute is that the one in statute would be a court-ordered, hey, I'm the defense attorney, I have my client here, and I say, judge, I'd like my client to be let out of jail, and I want my client to go to this treatment program when they're let out of jail. That's what I want to do. And even though the prosecution may not agree to that, when that's court-ordered, ultimately, if my client's convicted, the amount of time that they spent in that residential treatment program can then be credited towards the ultimate sentence they get, which is different than a suspended entry of judgment where there is no conviction, there is no sentence imposed. Or the third concept that Senator Michicki mentioned is what's known as an SIS, or a suspended imposition of sentence. And what that means is that someone is actually convicted, as opposed to the SEJ where they are not convicted. But under the SIS, the sentence itself is suspended while the person is on probation to follow a certain set of conditions. And if they successfully do that, then their sentence is what's called set aside. So that person would not end up having to go to jail if they met all of those conditions. That's different from the suspended entry of judgment, because under the SIS, you're actually convicted. You just don't have the sentence to serve. The suspended entry of judgment is the conviction is never even entered. So there are two other vehicles in addition to the credit that's authorized by statute to be given for against a jail sentence if you are put in a residential treatment program pretrial. So three options.
And actually, I think there might be a fourth. And first, I have to declare a conflict of interest because of family members' relationship to the therapeutic courts and prescribing certain medications. So can you mention that one just to get it on the record, as that kind of addresses the same thing for simple possession?
So to the chair, you're absolutely correct. I was asked to comment on SIS and an SEJ, but you're absolutely correct. There is a fourth option for someone that is struggling with addictions. There are several programs throughout the state that are known as therapeutic courts. They're actually a type of program that's found all across the nation. The idea is that we find individuals who come into the criminal justice system because of substance abuse problems, addictions, and by putting them into the court then monitors them as opposed to a probation officer. They sign agreements coming into the therapeutic court that they need to go through and do certain things. And if they successfully complete all of those things, then, in fact, there can be a reduction in terms of what happens, whether it's a reduced sentence, whether it's avoiding the conviction. But that's a therapeutic court. And the difference between the therapeutic court and the suspended entry of judgment is the suspended entry of judgment is something that's done by an agreement between the two parties, whereas the therapeutic court is something that is monitored and managed by the court, by the judge. So different folks through the system all working towards the same goal. There are different avenues to try and get to that same concept, some run by the court, some that are simply handled between the parties. Others, like we were talking about, can be pretrial that can have credit applied to the ultimate sentence. So all of those are options of how we can deal with those currently within the system.
Mr. Skidmore, is a person ever ordered to treatment that would be on an electronic monitoring system where we have a problem, where we'd have a crossover here with this particular where I just don't know if someone's ever ordered a treatment with an ankle monitor on?
To the chair, I actually don't know the answer to that question. I have not encountered a situation in which somebody was placed on EM going to a treatment program, but the fact that I haven't encountered it doesn't mean that it wouldn't exist. The way I would approach that under the statutes, however, is you have one statute that says you don't get credit for being on EM, but we wouldn't be giving them credit for being on EM. There's another statute that says you're entitled to credit for the treatment program. So if they go to the treatment program, eliminating this or the way this is read, a court may not grant credit against a sentence of imprisonment for time spent in a private residence or an electronic monitoring, it wouldn't be for the electronic monitoring. It would be because they had been in a treatment program. So my interpretation is that this statute would not interfere in that circumstance. Though I haven't seen it, if it were to exist, it should not have an impact on that.
Okay. And if you were to find out that there would be a problem, this, like you said, this measure is also in SB 33, so we could look at that if there, we needed to do any clarification on that to ensure that the time in treatment would be applicable. Are there any other questions for Mr. Skidmore?
I guess I'm...
Senator Keel?
Thank you. I'm just trying to think through a wide variety of situations, since this goes so far beyond the sex offender piece that we seem to have pretty good consensus on. I'm just trying to think through, you know, folks with mental health problems, and they're, you know, you've got an assault, three, somebody's off their meds, and they're swinging a pool stick around. I understand the discussion of incentives, and I appreciate the concern about whether the table is tilted. My concern is on the other end, and it's about sort of risk of reoffense. So you've got somebody who's out on an ankle monitor, and they're back on their meds, and they're going to work, and they're connected to the family, and they're back with a counselor. Where's the public safety benefit then in bringing them into prison, where they're not on their meds in general population, because we don't do psych meds unless you're on, you know, the worst of the mods. You're in with some pretty scary folks. You've lost your job. You disconnected from family. What are our options to keep that, make that person successful in getting back into society, when you're going to have to pull them into prison and disconnect them from all the chance, the predictors of success?
So, through the chair, Senator Keel, I think the mistake in the hypothetical you present me is the presumption that somebody goes to prison. In that circumstance, one of the arguments that have been made for all of the bills is the importance of discretion within the system. I don't know if you and I have had this discussion or not, but it's important for there to be discretion with law enforcement. It is important that there be discretion with prosecutors. It is important that there is discretion with judges, and it's important that there is discretion with probation and parole officers. The reason that discretion is so important is because there is a wide range of offenses that occur. Within that wide range of offenses, even if you have the same offense, you have a wide range of individuals that commit the offenses. And you've done an excellent job of laying out one of those circumstances in which someone should not be sent to prison, if at all, depending on the rest of the facts in your hypothetical. Maybe this person shouldn't go to prison at all. Or if they do, maybe it's only a very limited time. And again, the Department of Corrections still has that ability to conduct classifications to determine if this person really needs to be in a hard bed, or whether or not they would be in EM as the way to serve out the time that is imposed. But you're presuming that time actually gets imposed. And I can tell you, after prosecuting cases for 20 years, there's an awful lot of cases in which we don't end up sending people to prison. They end up with suspended sentences and simply being on probation. That doesn't mean that there aren't a lot who do go to prison, because certainly there are, and I would tell you that they deserve it. But the hypothetical that you just presented to me is not one that I would necessarily put into that category. Now, maybe there's other details that I would have to evaluate, but just for the plain, limited information you gave me, I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that a person waving a pool cue because they were off their medications needed to go to jail.
And follow up, Madam Chair, that's
Senator Keel.
Despite Section 7 making that a presumptive 1 to 3 years?
Section 7.
Assault 3, dangerous instrument.
Mm-hmm. So the difficulty there is that in your hypothetical, you talked about swinging a pool cue. And when I look at Section 7, I'm on page 5, and you get the 1 to 3 years. It defines a dangerous instrument as only being under Alaska Statute 1181-900 subsection B15B, which is when you strangle somebody using hands or other objects. You didn't describe to me this person was strangling. You described to me somebody swinging a pool cue. So that 1 to 3 wouldn't apply in that circumstance. But let's take it a step further. Let's take it to the step where you do, in fact, have a situation in which that pool cue was used to strangle somebody else. The 1 to 3 is a presumptive term. That does not mean the court has to impose 1-3. There are also things called mitigators, statutory mitigators that could be applied. And I would need to go through the statutes, but I'm fairly confident I could find a couple of different mitigators that would allow a court to go below that 1 year of the bottom of the presumptive range that's listed there. So under either situation, you can still be assured that that person has options to make sure that they wouldn't go to jail.
At this time, in relation to that question, I believe there's someone from Department of Corrections. I'd like them to come up to the table. Please join us, and I want to follow it up with a couple of questions, if you could state your name on the record.
Madam Chair, did you want me still?
Yes, okay. Dave, please.
My name is Jen Winkleman. I am the Director of Probation and Parole.
Thank you, Jen. And one of the things was mentioned that Senator Keel alluded to the fact that someone might be off their meds and it might be better for them to be out on an ankle monitor and in the prison. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that if someone is under the need of medications, they still can be on medications in the prison system. Is that correct?
To the chair, yeah, that is correct.
Okay, I just wanted to get that clarified. Also, in conversations with the commissioner of DOC and the goal to reduce recidivism, the kind of things that were happening over the decade where someone was not on an ankle monitor but in the prison system, I think Senator Keel's description was probably unfortunately too appropriate, that it might deter the kind of things that would help that person. They might be more apt to become a habitual offender and repeat crimes upon exiting. Can you just talk to us about efforts, just very briefly, at the Department of Corrections of how you're going to change things to help ensure that whether a person is out on an ankle monitor or in the prison system, that the goal is to reduce recidivism and the goal is to do everything that can be done to help that person reassimilate into society and be a productive citizen?
So to the chair, I kind of to answer a little two-part question here. When they're in the institution, we are going to do everything, as Mr. Skidmore said, to place somebody in the least restrictive housing that's necessary. So the risk assessment that's done on somebody, that will determine where we're going to place them. Once they're out on probation or parole, then our mission, and by statute, we are directed to ensure that we are doing everything in our power to work on their probation conditions or parole conditions toward rehabilitation. So I certainly can say that is where, and as we've talked about, and I know Mr. Skidmore said it in all of the bills, the ability to give the discretion back so that we can look at every single person that's entering into our system and assess the strengths and then the needs of each person and determining where to place them when they're in the facility and how to work with them when they're out on the street.
And maybe it's a little bit much right now, but I would like, and SB 34 is going to be before this committee next week, but Jen, if you could be thinking about things that you're going to be doing differently, some things don't require statute changes. It can just be a different way things are run within the prison system, within probation and parole, to be able to tell us how it will be different here going forward, where we were actually, you're right, Senator Keel, people that went into jail were more apt to recommit crimes, and how we're going to change that paradigm. So maybe next week we could bring that back up, but I just want to get it on the record that our goal is that we are, whether a person's out on an ankle monitor or if they're in the prison system, our goal is when they're exiting that they will be in better shape and we'll have a greater chance of safety in our communities. And so thank you, Jen. And Mr. Skidmore, I do have another question. This is going back a little bit to Section 9. Well, it is going back to Section 9 regarding what I think is a great change that a sponsor of the bill brought forward as far as the communication of the prosecutor to the victim. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, for those, and I believe that we probably have people that have been victims to sexual crimes that are mm-hmm. following these, whether they're watching right now live or when they get home from work. a lot of people in the state, you know, as we've mentioned before, more than 7,000 sexual offenses are occurring every year, not all reported. So I know a lot of people are interested in this. And so I believe Section 9 is something that is going to be of interest. So would a victim, if they feel uncomfortable attending the sentencing and speaking with the judge, would the victim be able to communicate their feedback without actually attending a sentencing? Could this just be over the telephone? I just think that would be helpful for victims to know.
Madam Chair, the answer to that question is yes. There are multiple ways in which that can occur. If you'll indulge me for just one moment, I'll see if I can't list three or four of them for you. The first thing that I would say is that anyone who's the victim to a crime has the ability to avail themselves of the Office of Victims' Rights. That is a group of attorneys that actually work for the legislature that help victims through the process to understand the system, to understand all of their rights, and they can actually appear and speak on behalf of victims. That's one option. The second option is that any victim always has the ability to write a letter and simply have that letter be provided to the judge. A third option is that the victim can talk with our office, can share with us their views on it, and then can ask us to speak on their behalf at the sentencing. And we try to be very clear when we are speaking on behalf of a victim versus when we are speaking in our role as a prosecutor and on behalf of the state. So those are three different methods in which a victim could be heard at a sentencing hearing that did not require them to attend. A fourth one would be if they wanted to participate over the phone but not be there in person. Again, that's them speaking as opposed to the first three, but it's a way to speak without physically being in the same room with the person that victimized them. So four different methods for a victim to participate. Any one of them are acceptable. I've used all four of them throughout my career.
Thank you for that clarification. I thought that was important to get on the record. Are there any further questions for Mr. Skidmore? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One strictly technical question on Section 1, the definition of or adding dangerous instrument to get at the strangulation piece. A question that came into my office, I could not answer by just reading that statute. It's crystal clear that hands used to cut off circulation and airflow count, but I think it's hands or other maybe objects. The question is, forearms, knees, are those covered here? Because those, according to some advocates who talk with me, are commonly used in strangulation and domestic violence situations.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's an excellent question, and the answer is yes, those are covered.
Thank you. Glad to hear it.
Thank you. So I'm not seeing any further questions. So at this point, I'm going to remove my objection. And seeing no other objection, the committee substitute is adopted as our working document. Is there further discussion by the committee at this time? Not seeing any. So what we're going to do is we're going to set this bill aside and bring it back up on Monday. And it is my intention to consider amendments and open public testimony on the committee substitute. And then hopefully, unless something else serious surfaces that we need to address, my hope is that we'll move the committee substitute out on Monday. And then we will also begin work on Senate Bill 34. So that concludes our business today. And seeing no other business before the committee, we'll adjourn and let the record reflect the time is 2:36.